and welcome to another episode of Father Mike at the Mic. I'm Tony Miller with KCDM, and I'll be your host for the show tonight. Our show is a kitchen table discussion of our faith and the Catholic Church in general. We are joined, as usual, by Father Mike Phillips.
Hi, everybody.
And tonight we have two very special guests. They are actually classmates of Father Mike's, who are back in town for a reunion.
Yes, kind of.
Kind of. Mm-hmm. Father Mike, I will let you introduce them since you go way back. So
we do. I can't believe how far back we do go, but they look a little older as I sit here looking at them from across the table. We have with us Father Jim Vorwerk, who is a divine missionary priest who has spent the last 50 years in Argentina. He has a lot of things to tell us about what it's like down there. And my other good friend, or our other good friend, is Bill Reichendorfer, who spent the last 50 years here in Burlington. And he comes to Mass every Sunday, and he gets to listen to me preach. So that's always something to talk about. But anyway, we're very happy to have them with us. So I think I'm going to start out with Father Jim, if you don't mind, Bill, and just have him give us a little rundown of what he's been doing the last 50 years. He and I are in the same class. All three of us are in the class of 1961. There were 69 members of that class, and I think we had four or five vocations from that class. And he's one of them. He was one of the very first to let everybody know that they were going to go into the priesthood. So we were very, very proud of him, and we still remain so. So, Father Jim, welcome back home to Burlington.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
It's always good to come back. I always get a thrill when I come across the Mississippi River and the Amtrak and see, even from Illinois, you see the St. John's steeple.
The steeple, yeah. It's a landmark.
Yeah. It is.
And that's the church you went to when you were here, right?
That's where I was baptized, made First Communion, confirmation, celebrated my first Mass as
Wonderful.
A priest. Yeah.
Absolutely. Tell us a little bit about the origin of your vocation to the priesthood, and especially to the Divine Mercy missionaries.
Okay. Well, I think I traced my vocation, first of all, back to my family. I come from a very solid, practicing Catholic family.
Mm-hmm.
Mother and dad, we were seven, five boys, two girls. We always went to Mass, and we prayed the rosary every night.
Mm-hmm.
We had the family rosary in our home. But I remember the first, like the awareness of a vocation. We were in fifth grade at St. John's. One afternoon, we had a missionary come in from Africa. And this missionary was showing slides of his work among the African people. And I remember seeing the pictures of especially little kids with their kind of their bulging eyes and their big bloated stomachs, kids who were, you know, hungry and had disease and that. And I was so impressed. I went home that day and I told my mother, I said, "Mom, I'm going to write a promise that I will be a missionary priest." I was 10 years old at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the beginning of an awareness of other, especially other cultures.
Oh.
And then as we were coming through, especially high school here, Hispanic immigrants began to come into the Burlington area
mm-hmm.
to work on the farms and things like that. And I became very interested in, you know, to knowing them. And so that's where my interest opened up to South America or to Latin America.
Oh, okay.
And then in freshman year of high school, our teacher, Sister Bernadette, or Angie Hotze, she asked me one day to stop in after school, and she told me about the Divine Word missionaries. She had three blood brothers who were Divine Word missionaries. One was in Japan, one was in Ghana, Africa, and the third one was vocation director at our center near Techne, Illinois, near Chicago. So she put me in touch with her brother, who was vocation director, and I became very interested in being a missionary. I especially like other people's language, their cultures.
Mm-hmm.
This whole, when you go to another culture, a whole new world opens up. And so I decided to join after high school. We graduated in June of 61, and in September of 61, I entered the seminary. At that time, it was near Boston. 9 years of seminary.
Nine years.
Just like
years.
Father Mike and I. We were both ordained the same year, Mike, for the Davenport Diocese earlier in the year.
Right. I was ordained in May of 69.
Okay, and I was ordained in 20th of December of 69.
69. So and you were around the current pope then. He was ordained in December of 69.
Yeah, just about that time.
I always pride myself on the fact that I was ordained a priest before the current pope was ordained. Hasn't gotten me any place, but that's all right.
Well, anyway, after I received my mission assignment, they asked each of us to write down three choices where we would like to work in the world, because at that time we were in more than 60 countries. We're now in 83 countries around the world. So they asked us to write down three choices. And I had heard about this particular area of Argentina. It's a kind of a subtropical climate, a lot of tea plantations, a lot of lumbering, and just a mix of culture. And I was thrilled by that. So I asked for Argentina, and I got my first choice. And so I was 10 months a priest when I got to Argentina, October of 1970. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Did you take Spanish in high school to prepare you in any way?
I took 2 years of Spanish, and I learned to say a few bad words, as we all do when you learn a language. I learned, some basic Spanish. But what really helped me, before my ordination, I asked to go to Mexico City in the summer of 1969. So I was between my third and fourth year of theology, thinking it would probably be a reality that I would go to Latin America. I asked permission from our coordinating team in Rome if I could go to Mexico City for the summer of 69. They gave me permission, and that was like the green card. You're going to get a mission assignment to South America. Uh-huh. So I went to Mexico City, studied in language school, and that put me into Spanish.
So you were immersed in Spanish.
Yeah, and I lived with a Mexican family in Mexico City. That was neat. That was great.
That's a good crash course way to learn a language, from what I understand.
You can learn from books or listening to CDs or stuff like that, but the best way is just, head first in. You make a lot of silly mistakes, people laugh at you, but that's all right.
I remember that you and I were both in Latin class in high school days. We had the same, we studied 4 years of Latin all the way from the very beginning of the first declensions and conjugations all the way up through Virgil, if I remember correctly. So, and we had the same wonderful teacher, Sister Bernadette. I had her funeral. She just died last year, just a year ago at this time. And I had her funeral. So it was a great honor for me to do that, because she was such a wonderful, wonderful teacher. And I know she had a great influence on you and her whole family as well. So,
well, when you're as a senior in high school and just graduated, what kind of research did you do about Argentina? Were you more drawn to the culture and everything, or were you looking at the politics and the country situation and everything at the time? Because Argentina in 1970s was not a real good place to be, was
it? It's not a real good place right now. It's kind of the history kind of goes in cycles. Well, let me tell you what, as I actually made the decision when I was in my third year of theology, we had two guys come up, one from Argentina, one from Paraguay, which is right across the river from Argentina. And so I became close friends with them. But there was three or four things that really caught my attention and was kind of like the deciding factors. First of all, I grew up in Iowa, and I know what Iowa winters are, Okay.
Okay, that's sad.
And then growing in seminary in Chicago, I experienced, even here in Burlington, I experienced 32 degrees below zero,
Wow. Mm-hmm.
So I thought, if I can choose my place in the world, I want heat.
I'm with you on that
one. Okay, I want heat. So I didn't want a tropical climate. I thought it might be a little bit much. So I said, I want a subtropical climate. Where I'm at is like a Florida climate, okay. The second thing was, this part of Argentina, you might consider it kind of like the Northwest United States, a lot of forest land,
okay.
A lot of animals. We have jaguars walking around. We have, a lot of deer and things like this. A lot of animals that are typical of a subtropical climate. And I just love nature. Nature has always been my second Bible. I look at nature and I see God, you know, and it speaks to me of God. You know, it speaks to me His beauty, His love, His creative power. So nature is always, in Misiones where I'm at, that's where that. And then the third thing, I've always enjoyed being with people of other cultures. I was just watching tonight before I came in the opening of the Olympic Games, you know. Mm-hmm. It's just so energizing to see people from different cultures, different colors, you know, speaking different languages. And I just find that so energizing. Well, the area where I'm at is kind of like a melting pot of different cultures. And so these were the three things. And then the bishop, there was a young bishop there. Our Divine Word missionaries had a number of parishes in this particular province. We call them provinces instead of states. So these were the things that really moved me to ask for Argentina, and I got my first choice.
You didn't make your decision where to go right away. You were in seminary for a couple of years.
I was in seminary 9 years. You know, I actually made the decision after the eighth year.
Okay.
So during those eight years, I was knowing different parts of the world as missionaries from our congregation would come in, give us a slide lecture, things like this. But my thoughts went more and more towards Latin America. And then in the major seminary, I began to work with Mexican migrants in the Chicago area. So that kind of moved me into Latin America. And then my very first experience, immediately after ordination, my very first experience was clinical pastoral education in hospital.
Okay. But
it wasn't just like one priest visiting. It was a team approach to hospital ministry. We worked at Lutheran General Hospital in Park Ridge, Illinois. There were six of us, just from my class. And our coordinator was a Lutheran pastor. Just a vibrant experience. So that opened up my experience to that. Makes me remember when I was a Boy Scout here in Burlington, I used to take the first aid kit of our troop, you know. So that kind of, I like to, you know, put bandages on people's blisters on their toes and stuff like that, you know. That was my first experience, and that was always very dear to my heart. And when I was ordained, the thought came to me, my ministry will be along two rails. You think of a train going along two mm-hmm. rails, okay. One would be reconciliation, mercy, and the other one would be healing ministry. And that's been with me throughout the years. So in all these years now, I did want to get the first 20 years, I was working in different parishes, you know. But then after about 20 years, I wanted to change my pastoral experience and get back into hospital ministry. So I came to the States, went back to our Chicago Theological Union in Chicago, studied medical ethics and other topics related to theology, and then did a 6 month experience at Mercy Hospital in Chicago.
Okay.
And then I went back to Argentina and became head chaplain at the state hospital.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And that I've worked in hospital ministry over 15 years in Argentina. Ooh. So it's been a very vibrant part of my ministry.
What was the parish life like your first 20 years? What was it like in the parish? Is it similar to what Father Mike would experience here in a
probably
parish?
Not.
Probably not. I don't think so.
Well, I was in this. Actually, I mean, it's the third time in this parish. I will probably retire from here now next year. But anyway, it was a city of 35,000. We had at that time about 30 communities that we were responsible for. I think Divine Word Mercy Parish has, what, four or five communities?
Yes, right. Well, we've got three.
Okay. Yeah, so. Well, just multiply that by 10. We had 30 communities. Mm-hmm. What would happen is, and most of these were over dirt roads, so I learned to have, they call them what they call the pantaneras, at the mud tires, you mm-hmm. know. I would go out, you know, into the country, dirt roads, get caught in a rainstorm where you change your tires and put on the mud tires, you know, get yourself all splattered up, you know, get out. But I loved it. I just really did. And people lived, at that time, like a lot of the farmers were still plowing with oxen, with horses.
Mm-hmm.
it was a big tea kind of producing area, and there was also a lot of lumber. So life was pretty simple. I mean, just really. A lot of people didn't have electricity. Some of the people who had like a Jeep or a car, they would connect the cables or the wires from the house to the battery of their car and have a couple hours of electricity at night, maybe to watch some television or, to get the refrigerator going again, stuff like that, So I've known this, It's interesting because my mother, she told me what life was like when she was growing up as a teenager here in Burlington. Mm-hmm. That was 40 years earlier. Well, I go to that part of Argentina, and it's exactly like what she told me 40 years earlier. But I enjoyed it, though. I enjoyed it. I mean, it was just very interesting.
So you didn't have indoor plumbing or anything like that? It was outdoors and running water and sheets on the bed and all that?
Most of the homes had the outhouse in the back,
Okay.
It's great in the summertime. When it's hot, you sit on that hole there and you get that cool breeze coming up, it's kind of a nice experience.
I'm old enough to remember outhouses on the farm.
Okay.
So, The actual Catholic school, the first Catholic school I went to in our little town, didn't have indoor water and running water. There were the rest, it was outhouses. It was a four-holer out in the, outside. So,
Argentina has come up, now because of, television and modern communications, Argentina has made great strides. It doesn't get to the level of technology here in the States, but we're probably, we've moved immensely. We've made giant steps from what it was when I first went there.
Well, what were the Catholic families like then?
Well, the Catholic families, we're talking families, 5, 8, 10 kids in a family. Mm-hmm. Most of the people we serviced, especially our Catholic communities, very much church-going people, families that prayed together. You know the famous refrain, the family that prays together stays together?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
So a lot of, they're very prayerful families. Television wasn't around, cell phones weren't around, obviously, So it was very, very solid families, mm-hmm. That was good.
Kind of equal to what it was when your mom was telling you the way it used to be with her.
That's right. That's right, Bill.
As we grew up, our families were tight like that. Yeah. And technology pulled us apart.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's still pulling us apart.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But anyway, going back to that, I was assistant pastor I was in two different parishes for the first 6 years, and then I actually became pastor. I know here in the States at that time, I think you had to be a priest about 20 years before you got to be a pastor, maybe.
Right.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I was a pastor after 6 years of ministry.
Managing 30 parishes, what was the financial situation of the parishes?
Well, see, a lot of the people, a lot of the people in the country didn't have cash.
Mm-hmm.
So we would go there for mass, and sometimes the collection didn't even pay for the gas, Some of those mission chapels, some of them were 20, 25 miles from the, But people would give us a chicken, 2 dozen ears of corn.
Eggs, milk.
Yeah, garden products, eggs, milk, this kind of thing,
Mm-hmm.
I remember a lot of times coming back with 2 or 3 chickens in the back.
That's wonderful.
But people were very generous that way, though. They helped each other.
Did you have a hard time getting used to the change in food when you first went down there from what we eat here?
It wasn't too different, Mike, because this particular part of Argentina, there were a lot of German immigrants.
Okay. Germany.
Yeah, Italian. So it was a lot of meat, potatoes.
European style.
Yeah, kind of food,
Okay.
Not the spicy stuff like the Mexicans. In other words, that part of Argentina does not use spicy food.
Okay.
People, you think of Latin America, everybody thinks of Mexican food. No, that wasn't. We were more European food. And learning to say it in German, learning to say it in Polish or Ukrainian,
I can imagine. Yeah.
Well, then, once you moved from the parish life and went to the hospital, what were the hospitals like?
Well, my first hospital experience in Argentina then was chaplain of the state hospital. So it was also a teaching hospital.
Okay.
So it would be...
And that would have been when?
Well, I'm talking, let's see, 2000... Yeah, I'm talking 2000... No, no. 1993. That's what I'm talking about.
Mid-90s.
Yeah,
1993.
Okay. I did. I was here in the States. I had gone to Rome to do a refresher course in theology and philosophy. And then I was here in the States. So I was out of Argentina for about 22 months. And then I went, actually, when I was pastor, this other, I did begin as a chaplain of the local hospital, a smaller hospital. But then as I became head chaplain of the state hospital, we formed a group of healing ministry. I had 24 people, lay people, and also religious sisters in that group. And it was just very interesting. We would go around visiting two by two to the, you know, the different patients, different wards. And then we would also, at that time, they had began the diaconate program, you know, training for permanent diaconate. So I would help give courses or talks anyway to these candidates for permanent deacons, how to work with hospital ministry, you know. And when you work in hospital ministry, you're continually confronted with serious disease, with human suffering, and with death.
Life and death.
Yeah. So for a person, either a priest or a lay person to work in that, you have to come to terms with your own finality. Is that what you call it? Yeah. You know, you have to come in terms with death, you know. Knowing that someday it's going to be your turn, you know. And that's a process. I mean, you know, at first you're kind of scared, well, you know. But then, as time went on, I learned to be comfortable, you know, with dying patients, you know. I would go and hold their hand, you know, talk to them, you know, give them a blessing, pray, you know. Or just be there, you know. Sometimes it's not so much, especially with critical patients, it's not so much what you say, it's just physical, spiritual presence.
Sure.
You know, maybe just holding their hand.
Just being there with them.
And I've become comfortable with that. And then if I would be called to do praying for a deceased person, I would usually gather the family around the casket. And I would put my hand on the dead person's body. And, just, and I feel very comfortable doing that. It's very effective.
So it would be like awake here.
Yeah.
Kind
yeah,
of.
Yeah.
What level of medicine did they have there? Were they mid-90s? Would they have been caught up with us medically?
Well, they have moved up a lot, though, Tony. I mean, we're talking, you know, a span now of maybe, what, 40 years, yeah.
Yeah.
They've moved up a lot. In fact, that particular hospital has become really a kind of a central hospital in that whole area of Argentina, and they have equipment like maybe two or three kinds of equipment in the whole country, and we have one of them, you know. So it's become a very, very important hospital in that area of Argentina.
And you said it's a teaching hospital too,
so
they're training doctors, training nurses, and. And those people are going out into the country.
They usually come out, you know, that it's interesting to see them. They come like in groups of 20, you know. They're in their second, third year studying medicine or nursing. They come in a group, you know. It's kind of neat to see.
Yeah, I work out at SCC right now, and I'm a health simulation tech, so I work with first and second year nursing students and EMT and paramedic students, and we do simulation with mannequins. It's interesting to see them come in the first year and they're just getting started, and then by the time they graduate the second year, how much they've grown and how much they've learned, and what a change you see in them. That's pretty interesting.
So what I'm thinking here now, Bill has a situation at home where he is a caregiver too, you know. Besides a hospital situation or a clinic situation, many, many, many families who might be listening to us, you know, on this radio, also have our caregivers for loved ones and family members. And that's neat too, you know. You see sometimes how people get very tired, you know, mm-hmm. especially if you're the only caregiver in the family. So part of my pastoral ministry has been also to visit people in their homes, you know, as a priest, we'll give the anointing or just even go to prayer, take communion to people, and then, you know, help in energize them to continue their ministry.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of Bill, we have Bill here today on the other side of the table, Bill Reichendorfer, and another classmate of ours. And, you know, we've heard about what Jim has done. Of our class of 69, I said, would we say 5 or 6 of them went into religious life? But most of them went into secular living, you know, just like you did, Bill. So what would you say about your own journey in the faith from the time that you were in high school to the time that you had to listen to me every Sunday morning?
Well, I think life's a lot different than what you learn in school.
Sure.
You know, you have to go get a job, you know, and you work around people that you like, some of them you don't like. You hear words you shouldn't hear, you didn't want to hear, but you got to be there. Your family, you have to go argue for them at school sometimes.
That's right.
It's and then your regular things like paying for a house and mm-hmm. and the maintenance on your house. It's just everything that
sure.
Anybody else goes through, but it's nothing special. Hundreds of people are doing it. Thousands of people sure. are doing it. It's a journey, and I think it's been a good one.
Did you ever have times in your journey where you wavered in your faith a little bit?
Yeah, I think most everybody has. But I'd say, well, I want to quit. I want to get out of it. You know? But I think sometimes you kind of wonder, is he really up there watching over me? Uh-huh. Because there's a lot of things happening here that shouldn't be happening, you know. And I'm sure a lot of people that's, well, like somebody starts shooting with guns and people get killed, you know, and their families are saying, where was God, you know? I don't know the answer, and I think it'd be hard for the priest to have to answer somebody for something like that if it happened, you know, because
why does God let bad things happen to good people?
Yeah, you hear that all the time. But now, as far as just going through life itself, it's been a good times, bad times, kind of like up a hill and down a hill, you know. Overall, it's good.
Sure. Now, when did you get married? And can you tell us a little bit about your family?
When I got drafted in the service in 1965.
Oh, what a time to be drafted! Did you have to go overseas?
They sent us me to Fort Leonard Wood.
Okay.
And went through basic training and AIT down there, advanced training. I didn't know where they were going to send me, but they sent this group. They divided us up, and this one group was going to go to Hawaii. Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh, those lucky people. And we were going to go to Europe. They sent me to Germany. But the people that went to Hawaii laid over one night in Hawaii and then went to Vietnam. And that's what we found out about them later. But no, my knock on wood here, I was lucky because my father's family came from Germany, and he had old relatives. It was cousins and things over there that we've never met.
Wonderful.
So I got to visit with them and stay with them, and it was nice.
Yeah.
The only thing was going out on field duty all the time. Seemed like that's all it was.
Were you in Army or?
Yes.
Army. Okay. What did you do in the Army?
Well, I was in the headquarters battery, the 76th Artillery. Luckily, I didn't have to shoot the guns or anything, but they were constantly around us. You know, like I'd get so tired sometimes I'd go to sleep across the seat on a 3/4 tuck, and they're shooting the guns over the top of your head, 8-inch guns and 155s. You're just so tired, you go to sleep, you know. And I remember one time I was driving a message Jeep. Sergeants weren't supposed to drive. They were supposed to have drivers, but I'd been up so much, I just started off the Autobahn. It was in the middle of the night. And he woke me up, and I told him, you're going to drive. I'm not driving any farther. And he didn't argue. He drove the rest of the way.
That's amazing.
But, yeah, it's just little things like that you remember, you know. getting at that time, they had a demilitarized zone in between. You could only go so far, so many kilometers between us and the Russians in the East Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And I went over the line and got pretty close. And I got, there's like a final warning sign there. I found seeing that, turn around and got out of there because we were carrying some U.S. mail and some top secret stuff with us at the time.
Yeah, my dad was a Korean War vet. And the one thing he always told us, he had a saying. He said, never stand when you can sit, never sit when you can lay down, and never stay awake when you can sleep. And I've found that even from the time I graduated high school and went to college, I found that very wise information because...
You know, these little sayings like that make a big difference in your life that you hear people say. Like, I worked over here at the railroad shops, and I was on maintenance, and a man over there told me that, you know, you got two hands, one's for you and one's for the company. And if you're up high on one of them cranes and you start to slip, let the company go and you hold on because there's only one of you.
That's right. That's right.
So just things like that I've always remembered just stays in your head.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, how long were you in the service then?
Just 2 years.
Just 2 years?
Yeah, okay. I was just drafted for 2 years. Okay. And I come home in February of 67.
Okay.
And then I was going with my wife at that time.
Okay.
And my mother-in-law said, you're going to get married in 2 weeks. Don't you think you ought to get a job? And I said, oh, okay. So, you know, I just went around to all the businesses around here, the Case Company and Champion Spark Plug, and signed up, went home, got the IOP, all of them, got home, and I said, well, I signed up everywhere. She said, oh, this was in the paper last night. It was for the railroad shops. And did you try that? I said, I don't even know where the railroad shops are.
Yeah.
So the next day I went out there and signed up, and they hired me the same day. So,
really?
So cool. I was there 36 and a half years.
Wow.
So that's where I got my living from them and raised my kids.
And we're recording this tonight just in the backyard of the railroad shops. They're just behind us.
Yeah, we're not allowed to go over there anymore.
No, that's right. There's a big wall back there.
Well, Father Jim, did you retire from the hospital then? Or what did you do after the hospital? I'm only getting about 35 years total from...
Oh, you're adding up there, huh?
I'm trying to keep track here.
I'll be honest here.
I hope your mathematics is better than mine. But anyway, okay, I did go back. I worked there off and on over about 15 years in the actual hospital ministry. And then I did go back to parish work again. So I've been working in parish work, and now I'm as assistant to one of the same parish where I was pastor, you know, my first experience there. But there's three of us now at the parish. Our pastor is a priest from India, very good guy, very creative in his ministry. There's another Argentine and myself. So I'm in the happy position where I'm not in administration and I don't have to worry about money.
That seems to be the worrying about money thing seems to be a common...
This is great though, Tony, because, you know, I do a lot of spiritual direction. A lot of people come to confession. I say mass. At one time I was celebrating four masses on a weekend. Well, that's on Sunday, on one day. But now it's like two on Saturday and two on Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
I've been accompanying Worldwide Marriage Encounters since 2008, I think it was. And I'm still accompanying the coordinating teams in two dioceses in that part of Argentina. And I've even gone into Paraguay for weekends. So this has been a real strong element in my life. It's just great. I love to help people, especially couples, you know, help marriage, help them to look at their own marriage, to do good dialogue, you know, to get some shine into their relationships again. But I have decided I will be 82 now in January, and I think that's going to be my final date. My birthday will be my goodbye date to the parish. We have a retirement home for our congregation about 60 miles from where I'm at right now. And I'm looking forward to going there. I really am, you know.
So you've been in that same general area the entire time you've been
there
in Argentina.
There was a time I was in another province, maybe about 300 miles from where I'm at now. I was there for 4 years. But yeah, most of my ministry has been in this particular area.
And now, were all of these assignments that you got, did those come from, were you assigned to
well,
these
it's
duties?
it's kind of a come and go thing. I've always participated in my own assignments. In other words, it wasn't just like well, you go there, you know. Since we are a religious congregation, our assignments first come through our religious superior, and then he will coordinate with the bishop of the diocese. We're working in three dioceses right now, four dioceses. So he would coordinate with the bishop, and the bishop says, yes, fine, go ahead.
Are the dioceses there a lot bigger than the diocese here?
Well,
for example, Iowa has four dioceses.
Yeah, we have three. The total, I don't know what the total population of Iowa is.
It's 4 million.
About 4 million.
Four and a half million.
We're just a little over 1 million.
Okay.
Yeah. The diocese would probably be a little smaller, you know. Mm-hmm. But it's a lot of, we still have a lot of communities where, with one parish. Now, the parish where I'm at, it's Christ the King Parish. We say it parroquia, which means parish, parroquia, Cristo Rey. That's the way we say it, parroquia, Cristo Rey. We have 20 communities that we're responsible for right now.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
How many people would that be in general, just around
well,
the ballpark?
See, there's maybe? there's a lot of evangelical groups now that have come in. So I would say the people that are, you know, church going or at least have some minimal contact with Catholic Church, you know, we're probably talking 20,000 people.
Mm-hmm. And are the is Argentina suffering from the same lack of vocations, lack of priests, mm-hmm. lack of sisters, lack of nuns, mm-hmm. That we're seeing kind of around the world.
Yeah. Well, that's true, too. In Argentina, for example, we have a lot of people. We have priests and religious sisters coming in from Indonesia, from India, from Philippines. We do have some yet from Europe, but not too many. I'm the only person from the United States in this particular part of Argentina. So it's a different ballgame. I remember when I went to Argentina over 50 years ago, there were always a mixture of religious from other countries. We had Germans, Italians, Spanish, Polish, one other, maybe a couple other little Filipinos. And now we've got Africans, we've got Indians, the people in Indonesia, you know, so it's...
Can you put your finger on what's caused that reversal? What are the...
Well, the drop of vocations in the States, the drop of vocations in Europe, especially. And it's like, you know, the Spirit moves, God moves where He wants, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Like in the 60s, when Father Mike and I went, you know, every year there was, you know, somebody, two or sometimes three people,
at least,
going from, you know, I'm talking Notre Dame High School now. But every year there's somebody entering the seminary or the convent, you know. That isn't true anymore. And you know, I don't know what it is here, but the vocations are coming from Asia now, Asia mm-hmm. and Africa.
Mm-hmm.
You
know? Mm-hmm. I don't know when the last priest, would it be Gary Beckman maybe?
And from this area? Yeah, I think it would be. Yeah, that's 1995.
Yeah. We'll just take, for example, the Spiegel family. Three boys, three priests from one family.
Mm-hmm. One family, yeah. That's unheard of today, yeah.
To have five religious come out of a class of
69
kids, that's quite a high percentage.
Yes, it is.
And then to have one or two go into seminary every year consistently like that. It's hard to have vocations coming out of families where there isn't even a father present in the home.
Yeah.
See, a lot of families, too, and I mentioned earlier in this interview, we came, Father Bill, A father of family, okay. Father Bill, Father Mike, and myself. You know, we came.
You've just been ordained,
that's,
Bill.
That's quite a promotion.
We need you.
Yeah. Well, I'm a father.
I know you're a father.
That's why I said this.
And a darn good one, too.
But we came from very solid Catholic families. Mm-hmm. As where, you know, families that pray together. You know, in my family, for example, everybody went to Mass on Sunday, you know. And if you were too sick to go to Mass on Sunday, you didn't go anywhere else during the day. You were, okay, you're sick, you didn't go to Mass, well, you stay home. You
know? Same here. Yeah. Same here.
Yeah.
And we would sit down at the table, and nobody ate anything until we blessed the table.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
So this was family rosary. And it's, I kind of smile at this. Even as a priest, I would go home for vacation here in Burlington. And Dad took very seriously being the head of the family. So we would have our dinner and then maybe watch an hour or so of television. And then about 7 o'clock, 7:30, Dad would get up, turn off the television, and he'd say, well, we're going to pray the rosary. Well, having a priest's son, he presided the rosary.
Absolutely.
He didn't say, Jim, you're a priest, you know. He presided the rosary, you know.
My father did the same thing.
Yeah, and know? So I was accustomed to this,
yeah,
you know.
Sure.
But this doesn't happen a lot nowadays, Tony. You know, this doesn't happen a lot, you know. And people are so dispersed and, you know. Yeah, so it's, they've lost, a lot of families have lost the spirit of, you know, prayer unity. It's lost, you know, a lot of parents don't have their kids accompanying them to Mass, you know. And it was, so it's different. But I think those are very basic values that we need to return to. You know, each family have some kind of a spiritual tradition too, you know. That wake up again, I think, the vocations, you know.
Yeah.
And then we who are in, you know, consecrated life, either priest or religious, to give witness, you know, that, you know, this is meaningful. You know, I feel joyful that I'm a priest. I really do, you know. I love the Lord. I love the church.
Well, and vocations today are almost actively objected to,
yeah,
by family members and parents and that kind of thing. I know that it was that way when I was in high school and college and mm-hmm. when I was young. And we weren't really... I went to Catholic school through fourth grade, and then we couldn't. That was
too expensive.
Mid 70s, late 70s on the farm, and we couldn't afford it anymore. So then we went to public school. Well, then we went to CCD classes, and my age group, we were sacramentalized, but we weren't catechized.
Mm-hmm. We that's a good distinction to make.
We didn't have the Baltimore Catechism when I was in school. And even in Catholic school, we didn't do Baltimore Catechism because that would have been post-Vatican II.
Right.
And we did a show on that. If you want to go back and listen to that, it's on our website. And it's gotten worse today. So, and I don't know how you turn it around. It's pray, of course, but
I think people need to do. I'm sometimes astonished at the ignorance of good Catholic people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you talk to them well, talking about Lent. Well, they don't know that 40 days in Lent. You know, they can't maybe name the ten commandments. You know, basic stuff that we used to. You know, I think that there's so much on the internet. A lot of people now are using like their cell phones to bring in a scripture reading or, you know, prayers or stuff like this, you know. Like Bill was telling me about Father Jake's program on...
5 Minutes with Father Jake.
Is that what it is? Okay.
Yeah. Right,
yeah.
So it comes over the...
He emails it every day. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, see, these are a lot of possibilities that a lot of people are plugging into and using, which is great, you know.
I have the Hallow app, and I have a morning routine that I do every morning on Hallow. I have... I can't remember what it is now, a daily reflection and psalms. And so I do that every morning. And then if I remember in the afternoon and evening, I've got more stuff too. So I don't always get to those though, because when I sit down, when I come home from work, if I stop moving, I fall asleep. So.
But see, we have to, it's not enough to come from a Catholic family.
Mm-hmm.
Each person has to have a personal relationship with Jesus. You know, it's just... that simple, you know. You need time to, personal time, just to talk to the Lord and to listen to the Lord. Mm-hmm. Not only talk, just listen, but to listen to, you know. And that has to, each person has to do that, you know. Our families can provide like a framework, like a Catholic framework or a spiritual framework, but each person has to do that.
Mm-hmm. But your families have to give you the good example want to do that.
Yeah, the what's the saying about the family gives you roots, and but you have to get the wings to fly. Mm-hmm. So it's something like that. But like you say, the each individual has to do it for themselves. It can't be done for them.
That's right.
And so many people now, going back to electronic stuff, so many people rely on this stuff, and it's got everything bad in here that on the computers that you don't want your children to have. Nobody knows how to, our age knows how to block them and keep them out. Even if you do, the children know how to get around all of this. It's a bad influence. It can be a good influence, it can be a great influence, but it can be an awful bad influence also.
The amount of good information on the internet is probably offset by a factor of 10 with bad stuff.
Yes, and it's gotten to the point now, especially with this AI that they're starting in, artificial stuff. You can't tell the truth from lies, whether it's a picture or what somebody's saying.
Yeah.
They can bend you, whoever wants to.
And they've pretty much proven now that this social media thing, the algorithms that they're programming into there is it's an addiction. It's like cigarettes or alcohol or drugs or whatever. It's hard to put down. And especially when the kids pick it up when they're 12, 13, 14 years old, yeah. It becomes an obsession.
We always have fun. Play. It's a game with us. We go out to eat. To sit and look at the other tables and people that pull their telephones out and start right across the table from each other, and they're on their telephone. Sure. They're not talking to each other.
They don't talk anymore.
Yeah, that's right. Sad though. I mean, that really, that's so common, but it's sad. I mean, there's the opportunity to dialogue, and you know, everybody's in their own little world with their cell phones.
Yeah, and my wife and I sat eating pizza one night, and there were four high school kids in the booth over next to us, and they were all sitting on their phones texting each other.
Yeah, right next to each other.
Sitting in a booth in a pizza place waiting for their pizza, and they were texting each other. They wouldn't even talk to each other. We were just flabbergasted. We couldn't believe it. Mm-hmm. So, Father Jim, you said that you picked up Spanish, you learned Spanish, that you hadn't studied Spanish in school. You were immersed in it.
We had, at Notre Dame High School, I studied, I think, 2 years of high school Spanish. The same thing happens in Argentina. Kids take 2 years of English, and they come out, saying 10 words. You know, well, that's kind of what my maybe a little bit more interested in it, because there were Mexican migrants here in the area, and I was thinking about seminary. But yeah, I really got immersed in it when I went to Mexico before my ordination. When I went down to Argentina, I was 10 months a priest. And I went to Argentina. I spent the first, got there in October, and I had my first assignment in May of the following year. But then I also continued. There was a Lutheran pastor who was a son of Americans, so I would go to him like 3 times a week. I would prepare my homilies in Spanish, and he would correct them, you know.
Okay.
So I continued on at least another year, my first year, as a priest in a parish with some help, language.
Father Jim, was the Spanish that you speak now down there exactly the same as Mexican Spanish?
It's as different as England, as Australia, as Ireland, as South Africa. I mean, everybody says they're speaking English, of these countries. Philippines, it's, I think, some like 26 countries in the world that speak English,
mm-hmm.
and yet there it's different. It's different.
Well, even the English in the United States, yeah, if you go to the Southeast or the Southwest or the Northwest or Northeast, they've got words for things that aren't the same. So,
So this is true. I mean, it's once you get to know kind of other countries and the way they speak Spanish, like I can pick out a Spaniard right away because they have a different sound to it. I can pick out people from Paraguay because they will usually forget the S's, or they put on S's where they're not supposed to be, Like this one lady, she was talking about her husbands. I said, how many husbands? Don't you have just one? Yeah, Father. You know. But every time she would, and then she was talking about her Christ, you know, with the S on the end. Like, mm-hmm. Well, there's only one. And she would, she put an S on the end, you know. You know, this kind of stuff happens, you know.
Yeah, like, yeah. Well, maybe you could say an Our Father for us or something in Spanish.
We use, instead of the word trespasses, we use offenses, which I like better. Because when I think of trespassing, I always see these signs, no hunting, no trespassing. Yeah, so I don't, it doesn't get me the same way, you know. But in Spanish, we say, forgive us our offenses as we forgive those who offend us. So the Our Father would be, Padre nuestro que estás en el cielo, santificado sea tu nombre, que venga a nosotros tu reino, hágase tu voluntad en la tierra como en el cielo. Danos hoy nuestro pan de cada día, perdona nuestras ofensas, como también nosotros perdonamos a los que nos ofenden. Y no nos dejes caer en tentación, mas líbranos de mal. Amen.
Amen.
I like that. I don't speak hardly a word of Spanish. I like you say, I know how to ask for a beer and find the restroom, but that's about it.
It could follow along pretty good. You say words like offenses. You can hear that where you hear different words.
Yeah, or temptation.
There is a relationship between English and Spanish. And if you see it written, you can even pick up more.
Yeah.
You know, we would say like the same word we might say international, we would say internacional. And yet you spell it the same way.
Same way.
The Olympic Games, Los Juegos Olímpicos. So it's, you know, you see it written and you say, oh, I understand. You know,
mm-hmm.
So when you retire, you're going to stay in Argentina?
Yeah. That was a slow decision. I wasn't real sure what I wanted to do. But, see, I've been in Argentina for over, well, I went there, it'll be 54 years in October, you know. So I've been in Argentina more time in my life than I have in the United States,
right?
There's so many people that I've ministered to, become friends, work with in different organizations, different movements in the church. And so it just makes sense.
True. Mm-hmm.
It just makes sense.
But you're always welcome back here, you know.
Oh, this, yeah.
This is home base.
Yeah,
so you'll have all that extra time, so we hope you'll come
back.
So
I try to get back in summertime, you know, so I can know.
And he turns off my air conditioner.
Right. Now, the summers down there are like winters up here or not?
Well, see, right now they're in the winter time.
They're in the winter
time. They have kind of a cold winter this year.
But it's cold. It isn't snow and ice like we have.
Yeah, they've had, you know, it depends on where you're at.
Okay.
But up in our areas, they've had some freezing temperatures.
Okay.
But how long does it last?
Well, there again, it depends where you're at. Like if you're in Minnesota in the United States or you're in Florida, your times of cold is certainly different.
Different, you know? Yeah.
Right. That's like in Argentina.
Yeah, that's good.
And Argentina is a very,
it's very long country.
It's a very long country.
It covers a number of different heat zones, like being your latitudes.
Mm-hmm.
It covers a number of latitudes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, very good. We're coming to the end of the show. Normally, Father Mike would give us a prayer to take us out, but Padre Jaime, give us a blessing to take us out at the end of the show here.
Lord, I want to give you thanks for the opportunity to talk on the radio. Thanks for the work and ministry of Tony, Father Mike's, what is it, Mike? Mike, Father Mike with the mic,
Father Mike at the mic.
Bill, thanks for your presence here today too. It's nice to get together as classmates. And I just ask the Lord to bless each of our lives. Bless our families, those we love, those we work with. Bless our life projects. Keep us safe. Keep us healthy. And may we all continue to walk towards that great encounter, which is at the end of our lives. I always tell people we have a glorious future. We have a glorious future.
Mm-hmm.
So may God bless all of us in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit.
Amen.
Thank you, Father Jim.
You're welcome.
Appreciate it. Father Mike, Bill.
Father Bill.
almost made you father, too.
Again.
thanks for another wonderful show. This one makes lucky number 13.
Is Father this 13?
Mike. This is number That's 13.
Good. I hope so.
I tried to get cookies but for a baker's dozen, but my wife's out of town. So I'd also like to thank our listeners for sticking with us to the end of the show. Please join us again on the radio or listen on the internet at kcdmradio.org. Check out the After the Show show on the internet, where we'll continue talking about the questions we couldn't get to in the first hour. Remember, God loves you and has a plan for your life. You don't need to become a priest to have an impact on the church Jesus founded more than 2,000 years ago. Have a blessed rest of your day. We'll talk to you again on the next episode of Father Mike at the Mic.
Let me tell you about 13. That is my blessed lucky number. I'm a devotion, well, I had some eye trouble, I still do. And so St. Lucy, her feast is December 13th, mm-hmm. Okay?
Okay.
There's a Chilean saint, her name is St. Teresa of the Andes, her feast is July 13th, okay? Fatima was May 13th, mm-hmm. Okay? Pope Francis was elected on the 13th day of the third month of the 13th year. Mm-hmm. Jesus with his 12 apostles are 13 people.
Oh, okay.
So when I get 13, wow, that's
good. So it's very appropriate. You're here on the 13th.
Yeah, I get 13. I, you know, that's my lucky number.
Ooh,
that's my lucky number.
Can I give you my little humble story about 13?
Yeah.
You have a humble story?
Yeah. When they were sent me to Europe,
they
sent me to Fort Dix, and it was barracks number 13, and it was on the, I don't remember what month it was, but it was the 13th, and I got 13 letters in my last name. And I thought, I'm going that way and not Vietnam. I thought it was pretty darn lucky, you know.
Good for you.
My lucky number two.
My dad always said that Friday the 13th in Korea was always a good day because the leaders and the generals and everything were superstitious.
So they didn't go to war.
So they didn't go to war on the Friday the 13th. He said the 14th is always hell, but the Friday the 13th were always good. So
yeah. We have it's Tuesday the 13th down there in Argentina. But as I say, I get a 13 and I rejoice.
You're
I
mean, just happy.
It's a blessing. It's my blessed number. You know, 13. I'm just happy.
It's wonderful.
So what do you have left scheduled in town before you go back?
Well, I've got just Thursday, I will be going, my sister and my brother-in-law will be coming into town. He's Ertz, Tom Ertz, the Ertz family.
Okay.
Okay. So they're going to be here coming in Monday, and then on Thursday, we're going up to Des Moines to have the family reunion. And then we'll be there till Sunday the 4th. And then I'm going with my brother Mike by car to New Jersey. When I was back in the States here for about 6.5 years, I worked at a Hispanic parish in Neptune, New Jersey.
Okay.
Close there. So I'll be going to New Jersey, spend some days, flying back to Chicago, and I won't be coming back to Iowa anymore. So then I get in August 12th in Chicago. August 13th, I have a baptism of great-nephew. His name is also James, by the way.
Mm-hmm. On August 13th.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. It's okay, 13. Okay. See, that's how things work. Okay. Uh-huh. But anyway, the interesting thing, this little guy, he weighed in at 6 pounds, 14 ounces. That was the exact weight I had when I was born.
Really?
You know.
Yeah.
Hmm. And then on August 15th, I'll be flying out. My sister, she's living in Wichita. We're going to meet in Atlanta. I'll be coming from Chicago. She's from Wichita. We'll meet in Atlanta and then fly on together to Argentina. Mm. She's going to be there for about a week.
Ooh, how nice. Yeah.
Does your family get to Argentina very often?
Like once every 2,000 years.
So is this the first time for her then, too?
First time, yeah. Those in my immediate family, well, Ted was the one. He came down 1974. And then when I turned 70, Kathy, my youngest sister, with her husband, and Steve, who, Steve, you know Steve, mm-hmm. he and Pat, they came down together, the two couples, for my 70th birthday.
Wonderful.
So then 2 years ago, my brother Mike is a forestry engineer. I wanted him to see the area because there's so many trees and all. So he came down two years ago, and then now Ann will come down. The only one who won't see Argentina is my brother Joe, who lives in Texas, but he's 83 now, and I don't think he'll. Mm-hmm. I wish my folks could have seen that, but they never got there.
So how long have you been in?
Well,
back in the United
States? I got
States?
Back June 24th. In other words, Monday, I think it will be, what's today?
Today's the 26th, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So, yeah, it's been a
so
month
been
and
a month.
Couple of days, yeah. It'd be 7 weeks and all, I'll be in the States. Ooh. I can stay up to 3 months, but that's too long.
So if Mike and I decide to come down to see you, we can. You got a room for us down there?
Well, No, we've got a couple guest rooms at the parish. The fact is that our parish is kind of in a central area, and some of the other priests will come in if they need to do some, you know, go to the doctor, stuff like that. So we always have a couple rooms where, you know, other people can come in and stay overnight.
Now, do you have to turn in your resignation to the bishop at 75 like the priests up here do?
No, I tried that, and the bishop said...
He won't let you.
I was working at the hospital at the time. Retirement age in Argentina is 65. Okay. I was 76. So I, you know, gave 11 more years. So I turned in, I wrote a very nice letter to the bishop, and you know, all this. I was 76 at the time. And I said, Bishop, you know, I think it's time. First of all, I sent the letter to the chancery office, and then I asked for an interview with the bishop, you know. So he had time to read the letter. So I go in, he says, Jaime, you're doing great, good, great. Keep it going. I don't want you.
I've heard that before. Yeah.
So I said, I was thinking. No, I said, yeah, I hear very good things about you. Keep it going. So I said, okay, give me a blessing so that I can do what you're asking me to do. So he gave me his blessing. Now he said, now give me your blessing. So I blessed the bishop.
That's good.
So I went another, that was in August 2018. So I went till September 2019. So it isn't like we're waiting for you to retire. Just keep going.
No, John Paul was like that too. As long as you could walk, he still wanted you to, you know.
But see, what I want to do now, Tony, I've got, well, first of all, I want more time to read while I still have, you know, eyesight. My big project is I want to prepare and print my homilies.
Oh, okay.
I've got the three cycles, ABC. I've got, you know, the Advent, Christmas, Lent, Easter. Mm-hmm. And then we've got special feasts, you know, that I want to. So what I'm going to do is like a ring, you know, you know, kind of an economic kind of binder, you know, with the little rings, or, you know. So that's what I want to do.
Plenty of time to do that.
I need somebody to help me with the computer because my eyes are limited, you know, so they get tired very quickly. So I'm going to have somebody who can help me with a computer. I can sit next to the person and say, well, you know, do this. But that's going to be my project my first year.
So do you have your homilies written down? Are they?
I've got a computer. I've got some on paper. Most of them are in computer. So that's a lot easier. You know, some are not, and so I would have to get those into. You know,
get them typed up.
Yeah. I got a question here. That my wife worked as a secretary over here at this Methodist church.
Okay.
Minister over there at that time, he had a beard. I can't tell you his name, but anyway, he had a file with his homilies in it, mm-hmm. and what he was going to speak on, he'd just go get one out, and he didn't have to read.
Redo it?
Yeah, I guess he knew him. You guys,
everybody see,
do that
I
pretty
do,
much?
No, I do that. I don't know. Some of them, I just have like little, you know, phrases that kind of to guide me through, you know. I remember when I was in New Jersey, it was a bilingual parish, so I would prepare my homily in one language and then just wing it in the other language. You know, I could do that, you know. Like what you have there, I can just take it, look at it, and say it in Spanish, for example. But I would maybe put a couple words there just to kind of, you know, help me through that. So I still have some of my homilies from other times like this. usually what I do, okay, well, say we get up, Sunday's coming up. So what I do, usually by Tuesday, I look at the scripture readings for the following Sunday, you know, and start, you know, thinking, you know, getting some ideas. And then I go back either to the computer or my file cabinet and see if I have something on that particular, you know, week of that particular reading. Many times I do, sometimes I don't, you know. And so then what I'll do is, you know, first of all, what I like to do, I got these little missalettes, you know. So what I'll read and I'll start underlining, you know, and then write down next to it what, you know, some ideas that come to me. And then I'll compare that with, if I have a homily, I'll compare that with what I've got written maybe from, you know, 3 years before that or whatever it was, you know. This, we're 3 year cycles, ABC, you know. sometimes I go with the gospel. Sometimes I go with the first reading, with the second reading, just kind of where, you know, the Spirit moves, you know. sometimes I might take something that's happened just recently, you know, and kind of, you know, mention that incident and, you know, tell about, you know, what's the Spirit saying on this, you know.
But I found when I lecture, I've gotten into the habit now of, like you say, Tuesday, look at the reading, and then go back and read it again on Wednesday and go, do I really understand what I'm reading here? Keep reading it until I do understand what I'm reading, and then it comes out much better when you're
there's some text, like, oh gosh, I don't want to talk on that, you know. But then sometimes the first reading, especially a couple, you know, like Old Testament texts or whatever, it doesn't say anything to me, you know. So, well, you know, what am I going to say this, you know? But then as you get back into it, you know, you begin to discover a word here, a word there, that kind of enlightens, you know, what you might want to say.
And you get into some of those letters from St. Paul where you wish he would have invested in a little punctuation, you know.
That's it. When do you take a breath?
Some of those, some of those sentences get pretty long.
Yeah. Well, see, what I'll do then, I'll even do this, though. I will take, if it's one of these texts where you got all these, what I'll do is synthesize this on, you know, on the computer and maybe use that, taking out words and phrases so that people can understand it. Because if you read it as it's written, you know, you get lost. You get lost in it. You know, so trying to reduce
that's
it.
That's what I like, Father Mike sermons. He'll be going along and he'll stop and talk about something that everybody knows about, everybody, about regular people's lives and things like that, or about what, you know, what's happening, you know. It's not just all straight stuff, but it keeps people's attentions, I think, more.
Yeah, put it in terms that are meaningful to people's lives right now.
Well, yeah, and I don't know. I always say people's more educated now than they used to be, but I think when you look at people's spelling, it's not true, but you got to bring it down to their level so people can understand more.
Yeah.
I think Mike's real good at doing that.
I remember our first bishop in this area, he was telling us, he said, look, guys, he said, you're talking to people who might have a second or third grade education, you know. He said, if you give them three lectures, or three scripture readings in a psalm, it's like telling them to eat 2 pounds of meat at a meal, you know. They just can't, you know. So he said, you know, pick out two readings. Sometimes I use all three, but a lot of times I use just two readings, and then just, you know, maybe take, but you really have to bring it down. Otherwise, it's, you know, it might be a great homily, but you meet them after, how'd you like that? Fine, Father, what'd you talk about? I don't remember.
You know, so. Can you see that from the pulpit when you look out at people's faces like they're gone?
You can tell if they're with you or not. Yeah, absolutely.
I'm going to say I figured you probably could, because you're looking at me all the time.
You can tell who's not with you. Very much so.
Well, it's funny, in journalism school, I've got a journalism degree. I was a photographer. I was actually, my emphasis was visual communications, but in journalism school, they used to tell you that when you're writing for in a newspaper, you were writing for basically an eighth grade education.
Mm-hmm. Maybe even less.
If you ventured above eighth grade education, you
lost them.
You lost them. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You were writing above their heads. You're in college going, really? Eighth grade? And it's not that far off.
You can talk to almost any teacher nowadays and they'll tell you that they've got to pass the children. They can't flunk them. They got to pass them.
Yeah.
Well, they're not ready to be passed to the next grade yet. No. But they got to do it.
No. I just talked to somebody today about education and we need to go back to reading, writing, and arithmetic.
Basic stuff.
And go back to giving these students the core education, because if you don't know your multiplication tables, I don't care how many boxes you draw and how many things you put in the middle of the boxes. If you don't know that 5 times 3 is 15, none of that's going to make any sense or help you.
That's right.
Phonics and reading and everything else is the same way. If you don't have the base education, the rest of that stuff is just going to be lost.
You know, that's you go down here to Cantrell, to the Amish, the guy mm-hmm. that the grocery store down there. Mm-hmm. Those little Amish girls don't make mistakes when they do math. And they've got those little like one room schoolhouses mm-hmm. that we used to have years ago. And that was always, the teacher taught the first kid how to do it. Then when she was busy with these first graders and kindergartners, this kid that learned it the year before is teaching it to the other kids. And I think that was a really great way of teaching.
Because
it's not like your teacher's looking down at you. You got another kid your own level or just one grade ahead of you that you look up to. Mm-hmm. And they're teaching you how to.
And they're helping you.
Mm-hmm. And I think really the old people, I mean, my dad, he went to the eighth grade. Mom went to seventh grade. But he could do math and everything, but he couldn't do algebra, nothing like that. But math, well, he was a whiz bang in math.
Sure.
Yeah.
He'd get mad at me because I wasn't, but he was really good.
Yeah, my mom was the same way in spelling. She could outspell. My dad went to college. I went to college, and she could outspell the both of us. And you know, she never had anything more than an eighth grade education at St. John's. Mm-hmm. And she was the same way at handwriting, cursive. You know, you talk about cursive today, and they don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I see they're trying to do away with checks. You know.
Yeah.
Well, because and. I don't, how can they? I mean, everything's going on electronics, and anybody that's good at that can get into your electronics.
Sure.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like for this little phone here, they sent me a thing that says, if you pay your bill by check, they'll take the number off your check and then just start taking it out of your bank account automatic. Well, I didn't know they could do that just by the numbers on my checks. Yeah. I thought that was just a number that the banks use.
No, because your bank routing number and your account number are on your checks. So that's all they need.
Well, then I wonder if you write a check out someplace else, or say you lost one out of your car. Can anybody get into your bank account then?
Yeah, there are some protections too, but a lot of people can hack in. You know.
There's nothing sacred anymore.
Are you a deacon, Tony?
No. When was that? When was Faith Festival? How long ago was that? 98, 99, mm-hmm. something like that? It was before 2000s.
Yeah.
I spoke, we had a faith festival where we had parishioners that got up and told their story.
Was that out in Cripple Park?
Yes.
I was there.
Out in the band shell.
I was there.
And I got up and did a presentation and...
I know where he lived. I can tell you his house.
Is he from Arlington?
I've been over his house.
Yeah.
Okay. So I know who you would talk
anyway,
about. I know him, yeah.
He came up afterwards and said, Tony, you ever thought about being a deacon? Yeah, it's crossed my mind. The problem I ran into is... in order to be a deacon, your wife has to agree to it too.
That's right.
And that wasn't.
She didn't want that.
No, that wasn't. She that wasn't something that she wanted. So.
Yeah, what ties you both down? She's got to be.
Yeah, she's got to be in on it. She's got to be in for a penny, in for a pound. So.
Did you tell her that if she died, you couldn't get married again if you were a deacon? That's always a good selling point.
She's
with some of them.
we argue almost every day on who's going to die first, and she's pretty sure that she wants to go first. She doesn't want to be here alone.
So. My wife says that's what she wants to do. She's going to die first. I said, well, statistics say men usually go first, so be ready.
That's right.
Yeah.
Okay, well, God bless you all. Thank you very much. Thanks for consenting to do this.
This was good.
I sprung this on you at the last minute, I know.
I'm not afraid of this kind of stuff.
Well, I didn't think you were.
I'd also like to thank our listeners for sticking with us to the end of the show. Please join us again on the radio or listen on the internet at kcdmradio.org.